Hello, hello, and welcome. Welcome once again to the Start, Scale, and Succeed podcast, the only podcast that grows with you through all seven stages of your journey as a founder. I'm your host, Scott Rittheimer, and today is episode 400. It is unreal. I was shocked if I was going to make it to episode 40, if I'm honest. And that's only because I had pre-recorded most of the episodes before then, before we even launched. But here we are, 400 episodes later. And I've learned so much. I hope you've learned so much. The podcast has changed names during that window. It's changed focuses during that window. And I feel like each 100 episodes, we get tighter and tighter on how to serve you well. And each episode, 100, 200, 300, and 400, has been a little bit of a celebration here for me. And it's become a bit of a ritual, but here with us today is the one and only Les McEwen. And for today's conversation, Les and I are going to pick a little bit of a fight here. We've both got some questions lined up for each other about each other's models, which, as most of you know, are very tightly knit together. So Les has the predictable success model. I don't know that I've shared this story on this podcast in a really long time, but I heard about Les from a podcast, which was actually part, I don't know if you know this, Les, but it's part of why I do podcasting, is because the podcast where I heard you, I don't even know what podcast it was on, but it was just an episode with you and it changed my life. It really genuinely did. We implemented predictable success at my company that I was leading at the time, tripled our bottom line, and I think you got probably about $2.30 out of the deal from the book sale. I bought the audiobook as well. And you know, we bought copies for everybody. So it's probably like $2.45. But it just totally transformed my life. And so as I was transitioning out of that company, sold it and was trying to figure out what I wanted to do next, the answer was pretty obvious. I wanted to help people out of whitewater. And the best way to do that was predictable success. So for those of you who don't know, I don't know who that would be, but the one listener out there who doesn't know, this one's for you. Predictable success is a life cycle. It's a model about organizational growth and scale. I'll let Les set that up a little bit better here in a second. Radically transformative. My experience of tripling our bottom line, I've found in the world of predictable success, is pretty normal for folks that are coming out of whitewater into predictable success. And I have the ability to poke holes in lots of things. I'll just say it that way. It's the nicest version of that. And there's nothing about Les's model that I don't deeply resonate with. And so it's just tremendous having you here, Les. Love that you've shared your model with us, and excited to ask you some questions about it. And then the other model is my Founder's Evolution model. You'll have heard about that. You know about that. We talk about it almost every week. And Les is going to return the favor and throw some questions my way. So, Les, welcome to the show. I saw an early version of the Predictable Success book just recently, and you and I have been going back and forth about books and the process. As you know, I'm deep in the process of getting my book out into the wild, but. Tell us, how did, before we get into the questions I have here, but how did Predictable Success, the book, come to be?
Well, it's interesting because you found that buried in a massive email thread that I think I'd forwarded to you for a completely different reason. And I hadn't realized that the attachments were still all in there. And you're right, what you saw was probably a 2008 version of the 2010 book. And it was hilarious to look back at, as you pointed out without any chagrin, the weird chapter titles that I had and the funny little logo that I had and all that sort of stuff that was in there as placeholders. But that was all part of the fun, was evolving towards what it finally became. The book I put down to one very brief conversation with my then wonderful wife, solo wonderful person, Julie, around about 2007, where she said to me, you're going to have to either write this book or, and I'll extract the expletives, stop talking about it, because I had been talking about writing this book for so long. And I took her to heart. I wanted to write a book. I knew it was a book. It was what it was meant to be. And I had to plan it out to stay financially solvent for long enough to let me do it right. You're in the middle of all this, so you'll be aware of it, that, you know, actually coming up with the artifact, you know, the thing, feels like it's the hardest part of it when you're doing it, but it's actually not. The hardest part of making it worthwhile is all the other stuff, the marketing. And it's a little bit like, as you will discover, you think you've run a marathon, but somebody, actually the publication day, that's when they fire the starting gun. So I did a fire sale of my time in, I think it was late 2007. I'm terrible with dates. It could be as much as a year off. And that bought me 9 months of time when I just didn't have to work at all. And I just got up every morning and sat until I'd done 1,200 words. And the book eventually evolved. So that's the story of how the book came to be.
Wow. 1,200 words is a lot. That's a lot of words. Yeah, I didn't know that part of the story. That's very cool. So for those of you who either of these models are new, I'm going to put some links in the show notes where you can kind of get the least you need to know about these. It'd probably be helpful for this conversation. So we're just going to assume for the rest of the conversation, you have at least a basic understanding of what these different stages are so that we don't have to explain everything to explain everything. We'll be able to get to some of these quicker. But Les, I'm going to open up the first question here and then you can fire some back my way. But one of the questions that I hear a lot, especially from folks that are new to predictable success, is they feel like things are good, but they're not really sure if they're in predictable success or fun. Now, one quick thing on this, they don't come across that way. They all think they're in predictable success, but I know from some of my experience with them that maybe they're not. So for someone who either thinks they're in predictable success or maybe thinks they're in fun or thinks they're in one of them, but doesn't know that how to tell which one it is, how do you know the difference between predictable success and fun?
A quick litmus test is if you have to ask, you're almost certainly in fun. And I say that because for an individual to be asking that question, they're individualizing the sense of where they are. And when you're doing that, you're leading as the founder, usually, type leader who is in fun. When you're in predictable success, the question gets abstracted. And the question would be, are we in predictable success? And there's almost always a, assuming you've got past the first year or so, there almost always comes with it a sense of certainty at some core part of the business we are, or I wouldn't be asking the question. My concern is, are we throughout the organization in predictable success? If you just don't know, just assume that you're in fun. And then, yeah, you know, maybe you'll prove yourself wrong. But the key distinction, if I get pressed, I break out into two parts. One is, what happens when you're not there? If things degrade, you're on the left side of the growth curve, probably in fun. You might be in some part of Whitewater. If things get better, you're definitely in predictable success. Mm. If nobody notices or cares, you're probably in treadmill or in the big rut. But that sense of how individually dependent is all of this on me, is one touchstone. And the other part of the two-prong thing is sort of the other side of the coin is, how strong is the immediate team around you? If if you feel that you're actually taking things from them, your inventory of important things to do comes from their priorities and needs, then you're likely in predictable success. If they're working like crazy to try and take stuff off you, you're probably still in fun.
I see this a lot with very charismatic leaders in businesses, industries, or, you know, nonprofits like churches that are individual specific. And so they'll be in a period of ease. They're growing. It's bigger than it ever was, which means it was bigger than the thing that barely covered their paycheck 3 years earlier. And so a lot of that feels like predictable success, but that litmus test of how does it do when you're not there, I think is excellent. That's really, really helpful. It's really helpful. I like that a lot.
You know, if somebody's immediate reaction is, I haven't been not there for 5 years, can't remember the last time I took a holiday. You've answered the question. So let me turn that around a little bit and look at it from the point of view of the individual leader who's asking the question. As you track the founder's evolution, as we've called it, do you think it's possible for a leader to overshoot in their evolution, so to speak? You know, in my model world, to find yourself in predictable success and realize this isn't where I want to be. I want to be back in fun. Can you get to stage five and think, I'm actually going to go backwards? Is that possible, and is it healthy?
Yeah. There's a few different ways that happens. One is, I think, like predictable success, there's this idea that whatever is the highest one is the best one.
Right.
Especially in the US and I think the West in general, there's this idea that bigger is better. And bigger does different things and can be better, but it's not inherently better. And I think one of the reasons why the founder's evolution is so helpful is because we don't define level seven as the destination for everybody, that, you know, we're just all on our journey to level seven. It's actually the least likely by several orders of magnitude, because for most of us, we don't actually ever have to get that far. And so what ends up happening, I think, a lot of times is similar to predictable success. What puts you in level three instead of level two is success in level two. We don't really choose to get to the next level as much as we do the things that thrust us into that level. And so a lot of folks will, you know, they'll start in level two, they'll start bringing some folks around them in level three, they'll kind of crack the code in level four, and they'll wake up one day, usually in level four. It's not, level five is a pretty conscious effort to get to, but I see it happen sometimes, and they're like, why am I doing this? Is this it? Like, is this? And so for some folks, the answer is no, this isn't it. Level five is amazing. Let's go there. For some folks, it's, yeah, this is way past it. And if you just had your own private practice where you were doing the thing that you love to do, if you love coffee, don't get to level five and be a coffee CEO.
Right.
Right. That's not like, if you love being behind an espresso machine, then level two, maybe level three is all you need to do. And so in a similar way to predictable success, if you have any choice other than to go to the next level, it's oftentimes the right answer is to stay or maybe even go backwards.
And I'm guessing too that you can get to the point where you've, as you say, been promoted isn't the right word, that's got a very specific connotation, but in essence, you've developed into a leadership level where it actually would feel like a failure, or certainly there'd be a lot of peer pride involved in just saying, no, I don't really want to do that. You know, I just want to go back to my two coffee shops rather than trying to be another Starbucks, you know, but
yeah,
it can make you the happiest person in the world.
It takes way more bravery to go backwards. I don't even like to use the phrase backwards, but to go backwards, to return to a previous level. I call it going home instead of going backwards. But it takes way more bravery and courage to do that than to just accept the organizational inertia and try borrowing someone else's vision for your life. Now, I will offer, and this is a part of what makes this so hard and part of how it happens, is that I believe organizations of a certain size demand a founder or leader at a certain level. You can't lead a 500 person firm from level two startup entrepreneur doing your own thing however you want, whenever you want. So some of what makes that is the kind of golden handcuffs is like you get to level five, and folks who are in level five that shouldn't be in level five are some of the most miserable people I know.
Right.
Because they've got everything that everyone thinks that they should want, and they're dead inside. They hate all of it. And it's like, how do you say no to that? It's like you've got the most privileged position in the world. How do you choose to give that up and then go start something new from scratch? It's a really, really difficult place to be. It's a difficult place to be.
I want to just throw in a follow-up here. When I was thinking about things I wanted to ask you about the model, I thought this was a distinct question, but I realize now, having just spoken to you about this, it's actually part of what we just said. Talk to me about skipping stages in the founder's evolution. Is that possible? Is that desirable? Where does that fit in? You know my view on the life cycle side of things. How does skipping stages, where does that fit in the founder's evolution?
Structurally, no, you can't skip stages. However, the founder's evolution, like predictable success, is a fractal of, I think, a much more universal principle. You can find the same seven levels in the story of Gandhi, the story of Steve Jobs, and the story of Jesus. So in that it's just the founder's version of this same pattern that exists for every person in their story. You can do whatever stage you want at whatever time. But in terms of the founder's evolution, here's the most common example. Folks want to skip to level six, which is the owner stage.
Right.
And it's obvious why. It's like, if you could own something and not run it, and it just gave you a bunch of money and you had infinite time freedom, who doesn't want that? It's like, okay, that's fine. I actually don't want that because I'd be bored out of my mind, and I'm a terrible person when I'm bored, but I understand the allure. And so you'll get a bunch of folks that are, you know, level two, very successful solopreneurs. And they want to, you know, hand off their business for someone else to run it for them while they, you know, collect a paycheck once a month. Why would anyone do that? Why would anyone run your solo practice for you and not just run their own solo practice? And so you do that? Technically, yes, but that's not level six. That's just stepping out and collecting a check. You can borrow some of the strategies and privileges of other levels. For example, a startup entrepreneur can retire. They can just close shop. And if they've set aside enough money, then they can do investor type things similar to what a level six owner would do. But they're doing it not as a level six owner, a founder. They're doing it as someone who had a great career and has spare money to do stuff with. It's different. It's not level six. So no, you can't skip them. They are linear. Even if you move through them too fast, you don't build the requisite skill for success in a level, the next level will collapse in on itself. And so even if you could skip a level.
As you're sharing that with me, one of the things that I enjoy doing more than anything is working with family businesses, because I think the family dynamic brings such a juicy degree of complexity into everything that, you know, I can't help myself. I just love working with that stuff. And I think that is one of the reasons why so many family successors fall on their face, because there's a presumption that they've somehow got it, whatever they would have got from working through the stages by osmosis, just being at the dinner table every Sunday night and, you know, sharing the war stories and all that sort of stuff. It sort of has seeped in to them. Now, there's some sense, I think, in which sure, you're getting a mentorship that's free, almost. Well, nothing in families is free, but you know what I mean? That if you use it, you know, wisely, can help accelerate moving through. But there's almost at times a sort of a bit of an arrogance bordering on entitlement sort of thing that goes on. Like, I don't need to do that. You know, that's what the parentals did. They did all that stuff. Now I can just step in and make this work. And, you know, the statistics are very clear. The majority of family succession plans don't go the way everybody thinks they're going to go, and not in a positive manner. So I think that plays into that a lot, don't you think?
Yeah, I do. And it's one of the reasons why I was very specific in that this is the founder's evolution. There are an enormous number of benefits from someone who's not a founder to come in and learn from it. But with a founder, if I'm talking to a founder in level five, I know that they have been through levels one, two, three, and four. If I talk to a business owner in level five, I can't make that assumption.
Sure.
Right, because they may have bought in at level five, they might have bought in at level three, and you can buy organizational competence in later stages, but you can't buy the individual experience. And so unless you've had that in other environments, then it's going to be a real challenge. Hi there, this is Scott. Thank you so much for listening. We're going to get back to the show in just a few seconds, but first I wanted to let you know about my brand new Founders Evolution Quiz. If you're a founder, business owner, or CEO who feels overworked by the business you lead and underwhelmed by the results you're getting, you're doing it wrong. Succeeding as a founder all comes down to doing the right one or two things for right now. So take the quiz today at foundersquiz.com. Again, that's foundersquiz.com. And in just 10 questions, you can figure out what stage you're in so you can focus on what's going to work and say goodbye to everything else. Now, back to the show. Speaking of challenges, I want to turn this around for you. We opened up with fun and predictable success, which are not the most challenging of stages. But one of the things that I've found in helping companies, businesses and nonprofits, organizations, to use the predictable success model to navigate their strategy and how to achieve predictable success. Many, many times I've been in the room and you could split the room down the middle. You'd usually have to reorganize the seats a little bit, but half of them think they're in Whitewater. Half of them think they're in treadmill. Can you be in Whitewater and treadmill at the same time?
Yes, you can. That's not always the reason why the dynamic that you're talking about happens, and I'll talk about that in a second or two. But the reality may be that that's the case, that we've got two departments, divisions, projects, groups, teams, whatever, that are just in different stages of the life cycle. And you know, I had the sort of clearest exemplar of that I had over the years was a PR, a real old time PR company, Chicago based. And this was back in the very early days of the interwebs, when, you know, AOL were sending out CDs so that you could set up an account, that type of thing, who were absolutely, they owned, you know, old media. So, you know, they'd get you newspaper column inches, they'd get you on radio and on TV and all that sort of stuff. But they were plunging into treadmill headlong, if not at times in the big rut. And their newly set up Los Angeles-based internet division was zooming up and plunging into Whitewater faster than the half-life of, you know, a neutron, if that's a thing. I'm going to disown that sentence. I don't think it makes any sense. And I don't want to get engaged. And so, you know, I literally did physically sit in a room with people who were, half of them were in treadmill and half of them were in Whitewater. What's as likely, happens as frequently, is you've got people who are just seeing things differently. And, you know, if you've got a hard-charging operator, and if you've got a business that's succeeded and it's been in fun for quite some time, you will have developed a cadre of hard-charging operators, typically people who have become big dogs in the organization because they've got a lot of delegated authority, whether they would call it that or not, a lot of sweat equity. They've got their own, might be small, but teams around them who look to them. And any hard-charging operator worth their salt, you know, if you just put a spreadsheet up on your screen and they're over there, they'll smell it. What is that? You know, don't you actually have a job? Why are you? I'm being extreme, but not much. And so what often is the case is here we've got, a single source of truth here in the middle, which is we're just going to we're in whitewater. We're going to have to codify stuff. We're going to have to start writing things down. We're going to have to be able to replicate what we do and not make it up. It's too complicated to do that anymore. And for certainly for the processors, synergists usually, and a good day, the visionaries, they accept that and see that. And the operators, and on a bad day, the visionaries are looking at it and saying, this is horrible. You know, why do I have to fill in this thing at the end of every day or whatever? And so, yes, you can be in both. And that's actually easier to deal with because giving shared vocabulary, it's like that old cheesy story of the, is it five blind men, you know, blindfolded men who are backed up to an elephant and they each pull a different part. You know, one's got the tail, one's got the ears, and so forth. They all describe a completely different thing. If that's what's going on and you can take the blindfolds off and everybody can go, oh, right, so you are in treadmill. That's fair enough. How can we help? You are in whitewater. So there are mechanical things that you can do. With the other situation, you know, you're dealing with hard-coded DNA, just how I think about things. And sometimes just intellectual purity isn't going to fix it. Just showing somebody, it's like, I don't mean that the people involved here are bad people, but if you've ever tried to reason with an internet troll, eventually you work out that reason isn't on the table here. It's just not going to make any difference whatsoever. A waste of time. Now, I want to say that sentence again. I'm not saying hard charging operators and big dogs are all like internet trolls. It's just that the thing that's being triggered isn't something that's fixed by logic. It's such a deeply felt thing that's the work that's really, really hard in whitewater. So you're genuinely in whitewater. You've just got people for whom it really feels like treadmill. That's tough, tough work.
Yeah. I think that it's important to address both of those issues. If I could put a bow on it of saying, hey, we need to know what stage we are in enterprise-wide. And that the reason we're there is in large part because this group is there, this group is there. It really is both. And you almost can't address one without the other, but you do have to wrestle through the dual reality there. And I think a lot of teams come up short in that respect.
And in doing that, one of the, that's going to be a self-deprecating, say one of the few things, but it's not true. One of the many things that age has helped me with is that it's really difficult to be of help to anyone dealing with that different set of perceptions. If you as an individual have an emotive buy-in to one of those specific perceptions yourself, and when I was younger, you know, it was a lot harder for me to be a real sounding board, being able to be objective and stepping back from the emotional concerns of all of that. You know, one of the things that I've always believed is that the ability to be not necessarily clinical, because that sounds, you know, less than human. Clinicians are not less than human. So again, got to be careful. But the ability to be objective is such an important part of being a good scale architect, critical success practitioner. And, you know, although I have my own preferences when it comes to the work I do, I can completely abstract from that. So let me ask you this. When you look at the founder's evolution, where's your heart? Which stage is the one that you most enjoy being in? And does that affect the way in which you interact and help other people?
Yeah, 100%. So this is an interesting one, because if I were to just say which stage, because I've been through most of them, not all of them, but most of them, which one did I enjoy the most? It was five, hands down. Not even close. I loved the CEO stage when I finally figured out what that meant. And I'm pretty good at it. It works well for my makeup. And as soon as I got there and it got good, I sold the company. And I don't know why I did that, but I left that. And one of the things that I realized, I didn't have the model at the time that I did this, but when you are a level 5 CEO crushing it in one domain and you go start another business, you don't start it in level 5. It's like, same with predictable success. If you're in predictable success and you go launch another business unit, it doesn't launch in predictable success. It launches right in early struggle. And the same way, I went all the way back to level 1, had to figure out like, what does it mean to actually be a coach? However, when I'm helping folks go through this process, I don't think that which stage you want to be in is the highest and best way of figuring out where you're trying to go. For me and how I coach folks, and now they choose whatever stage they want. I think all 7 are equal. I didn't think that when I started the project, and several of my clients proved me wrong. All 7 stages have a valid expression that can be wonderful and life-giving and fulfilling and every bit of what you need it to be. Some of those is a little harder to believe than others, but it is true. And the book has 7 of those examples, so you can actually see it from the real world. But I found that to accomplish what I wanted to accomplish, helping other founders ultimately build an organization that they'd love to lead, that's really what it boils down to. I can be most effective at that, achieving that vision for this organization in level 2. And so I have, even once my book of business was completely full and the next obvious step is to bring in other coaches and start, you know, having them work for you and all that in a bag of chips, I realized that for the vision that I have for this organization and what I want to do with it, level 2 is undoubtedly the most effective tool to use for that vision. And so I have to make a really concerted effort to not accidentally get to level 3. And
Listeners, very quickly, just explain the difference between level 2 and 3.
Yeah, level 2 is on its best day. Level 2 is a successful solopreneur. It's you with a couple of people that help out. You have less than a handful, because somewhere around hiring a handful, the game changes, and it's not about you doing what you love to do. It's about you managing a group of people who does something that hopefully moves us in the right direction. But so level 2, successful solopreneur. Level 3 on its worst day is being a reluctant manager, but on its best day is being a skillful manager, where you have arguably the most control to do during your day job the thing that you enjoy the most. So if you're like if you really like to sell, then you can hire other people to do the actual doing and you can go have wonderful sales call conversations until you're blue in the face. So level 3, being a skillful manager, isn't about being a manager. It's about what being a manager allows you to do personally. Right. But it happens when there's enough people that you actually have to manage them. And so that's the break point. And I have to be really conscientious of that break point and make sure that I'm not, you know, committing to more work than I can do from level 2.
And here's an interesting thing. You and I share that. You know me well enough to know that I'm firmly a level 2 guy. And this is going to sound like, oh, well, of course, you know, it was going to come up at some point. I'm surprised. This is a podcast, so AI has got to be talked about at some point, or we're clearly just two old fuddy-duddies. Anyway, my personal discovery, and it's the one real revelation to me over the last year, is the degree to which AI genuinely helps me build a moat between this level 2 and level 3 transition, because the amount of stuff that I previously would have had to conduct a group of people to do, that I can just invest like a morning setting up some really good way for AI to do it and then put it on rinse and repeat, has been, you know, I'm not going to use game changer. It's just an awful phrase, but it really has at least helped me use some game tactics that I would never have otherwise got around to. Yeah. I think it's a wonderful tool if you want to stay in level 2 and you're going to try to minimize the gravitational pull into three.
Mechanically, what's happening is when you're maxed out in level two, you have three options, which because you can't do it yourself anymore. So you either have to eliminate it. Hey, I'm just not going to do that anymore. That's really hard. And that was kind of the only choice. Level two, the only way to stay in level two is to over eliminate. Just keep cutting, keep cutting, keep cutting, keep cutting. So you could stay in size. Then you can automate it. Right? Which, again, this is where AI and natural language processing and all of that have radically shifted what's available. The automate functionality 20 years ago was nothing compared to what it is today, which is nothing compared to what it will be 2 years from now. And so the third tool, the only thing that we could really rely on if we were maxed out and didn't want to eliminate was to delegate, which is why you had to keep hiring and hiring and hiring. And so, I couldn't agree more. I think what it allows folks to do is to thrive in level two at a much larger scale than was previously possible. And for us level two junkies, that's a pretty cool thing. It's a pretty cool thing. Well, Les, I'll give you the last word and then we'll wrap up here.
All right. My last word is a remaining question for you, which is, to what extent do you think you will be a changed person as a result in, say, 2 or 3 years from now, as a result of what you've learned writing your own book? Because I know that's something that years ago somebody said to me, you only ever really see true change in the rearview mirror. And that's true. And as I was being pulled through a hedge backwards in the stage you're at now with my books, I didn't see anything like the impact. I couldn't see what the impact of it was having on me. How do you think you'll be changed by producing this great, is it up to 400 pages now?
Yeah, it is. I don't know what the final print version will be, but I think it's actually gonna be longer. I'm the guy in the briar bush being pulled backwards. So I can tell you, I'll have a few more scars along the way. But one of the things, to pull this back to Founders Evolution for a second, one of the things I tell folks in level six to do is to write a book and don't publish it because of how this process has always already changed me.
Right.
There's something I've written a lot of content. You know, I've published a bunch of videos. I've done a lot of different media types. Nothing comes close to the structural integrity that comes from writing it out in a book. To actually get that big of a cohesive thought all together in one place, I think is a profoundly beneficial exercise. So I can tell you so far, I know that all seven stages are desirable. For some folks, I didn't know that coming in. I know that like how much you can boil down the world of what you have to focus on. That's so much clearer than it was before. So I use that in my own practice and reminding myself what I need to be focused on. And the process of getting that out into the world is so much more stretching than I thought. Like you and I have been talking recently about endorsements, and like the vulnerability of endorsements is uncharted territory for me. Cause it's like with this video, we'll post it in the world. It'll be live. We put an hour into it and it's out there. But when you've been writing in a dark basement room for months and months and months and months and months, and then you put it out in the world, that's a different feeling. So I expect there to be change there that I don't quite understand yet, but it's been quite the process. It's been quite the process. Well, Les, as always, it's a privilege and honor having you here, both as a friend, as a colleague, and a fellow thought partner. So thankful for you and appreciative of our relationship. Thanks for being here. And for those of you watching and listening, you know your time and attention mean the world to us. I hope you got as much out of this conversation as I enjoyed it, at least. I talked a lot, so I can't use my normal outro here, but I can't wait to see you next time. We'll see you there. Hey everyone, Scott Ritzheimer here. Thank you so much for listening to the Start, Scale, and Succeed podcast. I hope this episode gave you exactly what you need for the level you're in right now. Now, if you want to discover what level you're in, take our 10-question Founders Evolution Quiz for free at founderskiz.com. That's founderskiz.com. It'll pinpoint exactly where you are and give you tailored tips to move forward and reach that next level in your journey as a founder. If you got something out of today's episode, don't forget to subscribe, rate, or review. It helps us reach more founders like you. And let's be honest, it means a ton to me, my team, and all our incredible guests. So keep starting, scaling, and succeeding. And I'll see you in the next episode.